thank you for coming to this what will be a true conversation as it's built. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I was drafted for no reason I know to pretend to moderate between these two towering intellects on my left and right, Dana Gioia.
So to speak.
Dana Gioia, well, you're literally towering at the very least.
I meant left and right, so to
speak. Stephen Carter, Dana Gioia. They are obviously perfect for this conversation about the relationship between culture and democracy, given that they both work in their respective ways in the vineyards of democracy, teaching law at Yale, running a piece of the federal government in Washington, and simultaneously creating first-rate cultural artifacts themselves. A very good novel, now two, I understand, in this case, and many excellent poems by Dana Gioia. A glib answer to what's the relationship between culture and democracy would be American Idol, whose most recent incarnation had 2 months ago had 63 million voters voting, more voters than voted for either John Kerry or George Bush in the last election. But while this is a fairly amorphous topic, and I don't think we're going to come up with definitive answers or solutions, both of my confreres here have interesting ideas and concerns and I hope hopeful notions of the future of the connections between culture and democracy. And I'll start off with Dana Gioia, who I know has some provocative ideas to offer, and that maybe Stephen and perhaps I subsidiarily can respond to.
What I thought I would do is just start off by offering a couple of ideas for discussion. And let's begin locally, which is to say that we're at this Aspen conference, which I think of its kind is probably the best in the country. I mean, this is an incredible collection of people, very well planned, beautifully executed, wonderful, people, in terms of the audiences, and it's exemplary as a conference. One of the things, however, I think it exemplifies is the fact that American society, the power structure of American society, no longer really knows what to do with the arts and culture. Because this conference is largely about politics, economics, science, and technology. There's a certain obligatory role, well, we've got to put culture in there somewhere. We don't know what to do with this. And so I would say that this conference exemplifies a kind of irony in American culture, which we have this huge cultural infrastructure that we don't know how to relate to the other things in society. The second idea, to pull it up a little bit, is it seems to me that at the beginning of the 21st century, we can look back at the 20th century and see that what happened there was this incredible specialization of knowledge. You know, we had these knowledge communities, be they scientific or cultural, which created small subcultures that allowed them to do very sophisticated work. In the role of cult, now this is probably a good thing in microbiology, because the things that microbiology does are outside of the ken of the average person that isn't a specialist. But I would wonder if the things that a writer does, that a painter does, that a sculptor does, have the same kind of necessary exclusivity. And I do think that what we've inherited at the beginning of the 21st century is a huge cultural infrastructure that is better at talking within its own community than it is outside of this. And in fact, that one of the things that America lacks right now are cultural intellectuals who can actually engage a general, intelligent, mixed audience without condescending to them. They were saying, who would you like to talk to, with? And they gave me a list of participants, and I chose Dr. Carter here because I had heard him speak at the Library of Congress at the National Book Festival, and it seems to me that you do two things there. Once they re-prepare texts, so you get to see how good a writer someone is, how good they are with language, but you also get to see what they think about the audience. How seriously do they want to engage this audience? And it struck me as of all the speeches I've ever heard at the National Book Festival, he gave the best one in terms of the quality of the writing and also the audience that he was asking to call, basically to step up and engage these ideas. And so that's the reason that, he's been drafted into this odd event here. So I do think that, wouldn't that we had more people, that had that ability. And I think that we've created a series of isolated subcultures in our society promoting the arts in general. Thirdly, this leads into something else. I believe that the arts have not simply important, but irreplaceable and valuable human purposes. That if you take the arts out of a society, if you have a society of great technological power, of great wealth, but lacks, in a sense, the human development that the arts facilitate, that you have an unhealthy society. And I think that in some ways we are beginning to have this in the United States, that we've lost our notion of why the arts exist. A museum doesn't exist, I think, just to be a museum. You know, literature doesn't exist to people departments of English. That there's a human purpose of this, and that part of the necessary business of the 21st century is to reconnect the arts to their larger human purposes. Now, to back up those three questionable and unfashionable ideas, I would say that one of the things that surprised me most in my 4 years of being the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts is actually putting together all the data that we seem to know about the arts and things like this. And what I've seen is, if some of you have seen this, there's a report called Reading at Risk. There's been about, you know, almost 2,000 articles published in response to this about the decline of American reading. But one of the things that that is most interesting about the data that I've seen is that there is an overwhelming correlation between reading and arts participation in every measurable activity of civic and social engagement. Now, I mean, I was raised in America, so I naturally think that people that are readers are less active. It's a passive kind of activity. That intellectuals tend to be somewhat, you know, removed. Artists tend to be somewhat removed. The art audiences. An example, NPR has eliminated classical music and jazz in about half of its stations because they have research saying that people that listen to classical music are dreamers, they're remote, they don't, you know, they're passive. Now, the data that
there are fewer of them than those who want to listen to nothing but talk as well. It's a it's a democratic.
Well, that's another thing we can talk about. You know, this is a better talk radio here. you know, stepping on your toes, eh, Kurt? But you look at this, and what the data shows you is this. Let's just take it with readers first. You know, but the data is actually transferable to almost all arts participants. If you're a reader, you are overwhelmingly more likely to exercise. You're more likely to play softball. You're more likely, believe it or not, to join a bowling league than a non-reader. You do volunteer and charity work at 300% of non-readers. Now, I saw that and I said, okay, this is wrong. This has got to be something else going on here. It's got to be income related. The poorest readers in the United States do volunteer work at twice the level of the richest non-readers. And these are quintiles of enormous difference. You're more likely to go to a ball game if you're a reader than not. And what you see is actually in American society a kind of bifurcation of social activity between people who take active control of their own lives, get out of the house, become involved in their own communities, and people who are increasingly, I think, the slaves is too strong a word, the co-conspirators with electronic commercial entertainment. They come home, they watch TV when they get bored with TV, they play video games when they get bored with that, they go on the internet, and they, you know, and you have four people in a house who are in four different rooms with four different electronic, forms of entertainment. And so I look at this, and I back up all the way to a premise, which is saying, maybe this isn't just a correlation, maybe there is cause and effect. I can't prove this, but maybe there's something that happens at an early age for people who read, that there's a kind of awakening that goes on inside of them, which not only develops a better sense of themselves as individuals, but a heightened appreciation of the interior lives of other people, the existence of other people, a heightened sense of the complexity and the richness of the societies around them. And that if a society loses this, we may create a society that's actually, you know, far more egocentric, more interested in sort of mediating this comfort to this comfort, always having their little comfort zone around them. And that's what I worry about happening in the United States. that there's these two, and I can demonstrate statistically that these two groups exist. And I'll end with this. In the last 20 years, the number of adult Americans has increased by 40 million. The number of readers have stayed the same. So of these two groups, one is getting larger and larger. The other is getting smaller as a percentage of population. And that one is getting, the group of readers, of arts participants, people that have civic participation is getting older. And that younger people are increasingly being a part of this. So I trust I've said everything, something to offend everyone.
Well, the difficulty that a grand institution like this has in dealing with culture, I think, is inarguable. But I wonder about that correlation, which, as you say, I've looked at your studies and your previous studies closely, and I don't know enough about survey research, and maybe, and I believe Professor Carter does, to provide a better critique than I can, of what we need beyond a hunch that there is causality and more than correlation. It strikes me that it may just be there are the fortunate, enlightened part of our society and the wretches, and I don't necessarily think that bowling league participation leads to reading any more than I think reading leads to bowling league participation. But maybe Professor Carter has a different view.
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but that's all right. I don't know exactly why I'm here on the panel. Anyway, it's funny because at Yale I teach constitutional law and law and religion, and I teach about foreign policy and law of war and international law. So naturally here at Aspen I'm on two panels about politics and one about culture, none of which I write or know anything about. I do know something about survey research. We'll get that in a moment. But I want to say a word about reading. And as a writer, I obviously have a vested interest in this. I want to tell a story that I told in the speech that Dana was talking about a moment ago. In the summers, my family and I go to Martha's Vineyard. And years ago, I was at one of what were then the two laundromats on the island. One of the two laundromats. It was about 15 years ago. Doing the family wash, and I had my nose in a book as usual, and a woman I didn't know, older than myself, walked over to me and said, wow, she said, somebody really taught you to read. And she wasn't referring to the fact that I was capable of understanding the words on a page, but it became clear in the conversation it was the level of my apparent engagement with the book, that I was so wrapped up in it that so impressed her. I mention that because I really do think, and there is a little bit of data backing this up, but I really do think that there are things that happen when we engage a book, the physical object book, that are different than the things that happen when we engage any other form of communication and any other form indeed of reading. I'm not saying these are better things or worse things, only that they're different things. The book, to me, is the single greatest technological achievement of Western science, with nothing in second place. Because democratization, in the sense that we understand it, would not have been possible, I think, without the widespread notion that information can be spread in a form that is at once portable and permanent. Portable and permanent. You can carry it with you. But you also can't just take it down like a web page. There's something about the ideas that are being written down that have sufficient value to the people who wrote them and published them that they actually seem to be ideas that could stand the test of time. It's no accident, I think, that across the political spectrum in America, we tend to revere our written Constitution and our written Declaration of Independence. It's no accident that the three great Western religions are all religions that flow in large part from a written text passed down through the generations. One of the things that writing, that kind of permanence signals, is that ideas actually matter. They're not just something you play games with. It actually makes a difference what people think and how people think. I like to tell my students, I like to ask my students in some of my classes, what's important or valuable about democracy? What's distinct about democracy? Now, I admit, little footnote, this is part of my subtext. I always tease them with asking them to give me a reason that one should vote, which is really hard to do. And if you must vote, a reason that you should inform yourself before voting, which may seem obvious, but for reasons we get into later, is really hard to do. But there's a subtext to that. The point I'm making my students is this, that what makes democracy different and valuable isn't that everybody gets to vote, although that's nice. It's that everybody gets to talk. That is to say, what makes a democracy important as a form of human endeavor is that it's a shared commitment to reasoning together, to talking to each other, to making arguments and thinking about other people's arguments. To the extent that we do that, we're democratic. To the extent we do it well, we're a strong democracy. If we don't do it, or we do it poorly, we're a weak democracy, or we're not a democracy at all. To the extent that we think that the way you do politics is by nasty bumper stickers and dismissive comments of people about with whom we disagree, one-liners to dismiss people who spent their lives serving the country, whether on the left or the right, we're not doing democracy at all. We're just being nasty and having fun, which is entertainment, but it has nothing to do with democracy, which is a project of mutual respect and mutual conversation. The book, I think, helps encourage us, putting aside a certain kind of just nasty, mean-spirited thing that passes as a book. The serious book encourages us to engage ideas seriously. The serious reader, I think, wants to engage ideas seriously. Even, I hope, wants to engage people who disagree with him or disagree with her seriously. Now, for me as a law professor, it's hard to say that because in law school, and so I know some of you are probably lawyers, how can I put it gently? We teach students how to listen with their mouths, you might say. That is to say, the skill that our students learn is how to pick apart someone else's argument and have a quick rejoinder ready as soon as they pause for breath. And that may be useful in certain kinds of legal argument, but it's not really what's important about democracy. I think actually this is important about all the arts. I think that to the extent that the arts, at least the part of the arts often derided as high culture, cause us to slow down and engage in the wretched, forbidden activity, the secret, nasty activity of contemplation, that contributes to our ability to think critically about our own ideas and actually be willing to engage with people who disagree with us. You know, you go to the National Gallery and you sit in front of, you know, Monet's Two Views of the Cathedral. And you sit there for an hour working out some of the minute differences, and you go back a year later and see all the differences you missed the first time around. That creates a mindset, I think, that makes it very hard to then get on the front steps and start yelling and screaming about how whichever party isn't yours is ruining America and ruining the world, I believe. Now, maybe people don't engage the arts that way. Maybe I'm looking at this a little parochially, but I do think that in that respect, as much as many others, that the notion of the arts, but in my case I would say particularly books, encourage, they don't assure, but they encourage a way of looking at the world that is more engaged with others, more engaged with the idea, with the ideas of others, and more engaged with the disagreements of others in a serious way. I'll stop there so we can have some dialogue. I have more ideas that I'll throw out there too, but let me just stop there as a preliminary view.
If I can build on your argument, I mean, introducing yourself, you neglected to say that you were a superb novelist. And I'd like to take the notion of the book and the novel. It doesn't seem to me coincidental that what we think of as liberal democracy emerged most strongly in those countries which the novel developed in. Now, why would that be the case? Because, you know, if you think of reading as escapist or if you... And I'm not a person who believes in utilitarian social uses of art. I think that's almost always gives you bad art. But take this model as a possibility. If you have a society in which the educated, the ruling classes, have a daily exercise of imagining the lives of other people from the inside, think of the cumulative transformative impact that has. So now, this I think, and I say this as a poet, is one of the civic superiorities in a sense of fiction over poetry. Poetry is very much about peak moments of experience and lyricism or heroic deeds of aristocrats and epic poetry. But what the novel is about is the dailiness of somebody's life psychologically, socially, economically, both the, and the disjunction between their usually their external life think of the first novel, Don Quixote, and their internal life. The way they see themselves is always slightly different than the way the world wants to take them. And so you have people reading about a man stranded on an island who has to reconstruct his life from scratch, named Robinson Crusoe, or a young girl without a dowry who's forced into being a servant with a guy who wants to rape her, and just her attempts, in a sense, to not only control her own life, but to protect herself from sexual violence, which is the subject of several of the great early novels. Or a young boy whose family is ruined at the age of 11 or 12 is put into a blacking factory and working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, like David Copperfield. And so these people are reading largely about people less fortunate for themselves, people more vulnerable than themselves, people in different circumstances. And in a collective sense, it cultivates, develops, and enhances an appreciation of individual rights, of otherness, a protection of the vulnerable. And I think that this thing, in a sense, was a transformative, collective, imaginative enterprise, most strongly in England, secondarily in countries like France, where these things developed. And I think it played an enormous civilizing influence. And you can say that each of the arts in different ways do this. And I worry about, and if you think about that, part of what reading does, we think of it as passive, but it's actually quite active. You have to sustain focused, linear attention. You have to provide the images from a combination of your memory and your imagination. So it trains your powers of attention, it trains your memory, it trains your imagination, and it cultivates two things, a sense in a way of your own interiority, and also an acknowledgement and a respect for the interiority of other people.
And I guess the salient distinction for the purposes of this argument, which I hope is true and buy wholeheartedly, is that between fiction, between the novel and film, is the lack of interiority in most film, or the difficulty of depicting interior states.
Yeah, and also the fact that the images are given to you, the pacing is given to you. It goes from sort of drawing inside of you. And if you think of this in Jungian terms or Freudian terms, the power of art to pull up your suppressed desires, the deepest images of your culture and of your own personal psyche versus ones that are largely being given to you externally, yes.
Now, in terms of correlations...
Can I add one thing? Having said all that, and I agree with almost everything Dana said, and then I'll say why I say almost, I don't want to claim there was a golden age. That is, I'm not trying to say, and if you look back to year X, everyone was reading and the world was at peace or something like that. That's not my claim. I'm making a smaller claim about what makes democracy work well in a formal sense. That doesn't mean we get the right results necessarily, but I like to tell my students winning is not a virtue, on the other hand. At least it's not a democratic virtue. The notion that the important thing in democracy is to win is, I think, quite foreign to any notion of why democracy matters. Democracy matters because of how it speaks to the human and how the human engages in the democracy. I say this because of the following. One of the reasons I worry about the decline in reading, something Dan and I have talked about, in the younger generation. The younger generation is becoming a generation that's very interior, just interior to themselves. My wife likes to point out is the first generation able to keep in touch with each other regularly without any screening by adults, and therefore able to construct their own world of meaning. Each generation, the young people construct the world of meaning different than the adult world. That's always been true, and that's part of growing up, and it's part of organizing the self and being a communal self. But what's different about this generation, it's able to do that without any adult intervention at all in the communication. One of my fears about that, especially in an era when so much of our politics, so much of our popular culture, so much of our commercial culture is driven by me, 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 and what I want, rather than by thought or even talk about others, I worry about the extent to which the younger generation then will grow up thinking that what democracy is really about is getting my stuff. It's really about me getting what I want, not about other people at all. Therefore, winning does become a virtue. And, of course, we adults often act like it is, although I insist to my students that it isn't. Winning does become a virtue. Indeed, winning becomes the highest virtue, which is also either socialized in education and so on. There's so much socialization today to think that what matters most is getting to a set goal. that I worry about that. I don't want to claim that if all of them read more, this wouldn't happen. I do think that if all of them read more, especially if they read texts that are hard as opposed to texts that are easy, I think you would be able to ameliorate some of this for some of the reasons that Dana just said.
We're talking about, and the same thing maybe in different ways, we're talking about, because I'm not talking about a golden age either, but what I'm talking about is that there are healthier dialectics and there's unhealthies. A cheap polarization is not a healthy dialectic. You see, what you want are these ways, because you know, part of it is my interiority having to struggle with other people's interiority versus just living in, you know, in my inner life. And you know, and a technology like the novel, like the printed book, actually does allow you with the, both the inner life of the author, you know, going back and forth, and also with imagined characters mediated through these fictions. But I think that what we're seeing now is the dialectic is getting lazy. It's easy polarizations and things like that.
Which I think both fiction and good nonfiction in extended form, in book form, if you will, adds to people's appreciation of nuance, ambiguity, grays of all sorts that we see in our political discourse are unacceptable, are eliminated. But I do wonder if you agree with Stephen, Dana, about the primacy of the book as we've known it for the last few hundred years, or if an a disc can't be equally permanent and portable to what I love and fetishize as a book like everyone else here.
Well, I'm a huge fan of oral culture, but you know, I think that what democracy. I mean, but I do think that democracies depend historically. It's almost demonstrated, you know, on print and the kind of both the democratic accessibility of print and the permanence of print and the transportability of it. That being said, democracy is also about having a political structure which allowed something like the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which was a type of political speech which no longer exists. I think that, I mean, if I could change anything in our culture, I think I might change radio and actually have, you know, more serious, sustained things, you know, take oral culture and bring the full power of it. Because oral culture right now is kind of degenerated to what Stephen talks about, which is one-liners, quick comebacks. Clever put-downs, in which I think he rightly says is entertainment. And I would say that there's a difference, let me just end with this one point, that there is a fundamental difference between entertainment and art. They're related, they're not, which isn't to say that art can't also be entertainment, but entertainment, especially as we define it right now, is an interchangeable commodity which gives you a predictable mental state, a predictable pleasure. The pleasure could be the pleasures of safe terror, you know, like a thrill ride or a slasher movie, it could be a comedy. But entertainment allows the same person to emerge from the work as entered. There's no possibility of transformation. Where art at least opens up the possibilities of some kind, however modest, of personal transformation that occurs in it. And so I think that to the degree that we could, in a sense, take oral culture and bring back the vitality of unpredictability of transformation, of really serious engagement, serious dialectic, then I think that oral culture and print work beautifully together. But I think in our culture right now, print is really the last vestige in some ways of this. You are, I think in your show, is trying to do something quite differently. There's a program I'm going to talk about in a little while called The Big Read, where we're trying to use basically CDs and radio to have a kind of very serious sort of literary discussion that you wouldn't that might be able to reach people that you wouldn't be able to reach with print.
But I wonder, though, if what you were talking about a moment ago in terms of this selfish utilitarianism above all, and what you're talking about, this lack of say, radio where an oral culture can have its renaissance, aren't both the function, as many other things we could decry here today, of this hyper-capitalist, hyper-market-oriented economy in which we choose to live prosperously and for the most part, happily?
I don't think so. I people say that. There's some truth to it, but only a little. It's not so much that the economy is the problem. The economy is driven by markets. The markets are driven by individual choices. It's the choices we're making across a spectrum of issues that are the problem. That and our remarkable busyness. Let me say a word. This is related to what Dana said a moment ago. Dana mentioned the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Now, what was interesting about Lincoln Douglas debates and about a lot of political debates in the 19th century is not only they went on for a long time, which they did, and audience sat there and listened, which they did, but that they were then published and widely circulated, and people would read these very long explanations from politicians about their positions. We can't do that. The so-called presidential debates nowadays, which I refuse to watch, because they give you no information about anything useful, except that some moderators are clever and so are some speechwriters, that they are reducing ideas to a size at which ideas have no function. As if the function of ideas is to stimulate and make us think, then the way in which we talk about ideas, including the presidential debates, don't do that. Now, people tell me, when I talk about this, I talk about this a lot, I'm a kind of wandering nomad, where I travel around and talk about the pace at which we work and so on. People tell me the reason people can't do things like read the Lincoln-Douglas debate, the reason politicians can't talk for an hour and a half, is because nobody would listen. Now, why would nobody listen? There's two reasons. One is people get bored really easily. And the other is that people don't have time, that we're so remarkably busy. Our days are so full. Our children's days are scheduled and full from the time that they're very small. Their parents' days are very full. Adults' days, kids' days, everyone's days are remarkably full. That's a really bad thing. But that's the economy in which we live is one small piece of the social structure in which we live, in which so much is about getting things now and getting things first and getting things fast. I like to tell my students, for example, that there's a distinction between news and facts. Those simply aren't the same thing. And we confuse the two as though the thing that I heard most recently is the thing that's also true. I'm a little amused sometimes, you know, the many commissions reported on 9/11. You know, after Pearl Harbor, there were something like 42 investigative commissions figuring out what went wrong, and the final authoritative report wasn't published until about 20 years after Pearl Harbor happened. That's how long it takes to really think about something in detail, but nobody wants to wait that long. We want answers that are quick. We want answers that are now. And in particular, we always want to know who to blame. It was somebody's fault. Everything we don't like happened because there's somebody bad, and if we could only find that bad person, we can make sure that this didn't happen again. All of that goes to, I think, our lack of time for contemplation, the very thing that the arts in a serious way invite us to do, to step out of the rapidity with which we engage the world and to take the time to think. One of the things I like to tell audiences when I speak at high schools, I speak at a lot of high schools, is that the reason that some issues seem hard to decide and are very contentious in politics is not because the bad guys won't give up or the good guys haven't won yet. It's usually because they're actually hard issues. And when we reduce them to slogans and applause lines, we mask the notion that they may actually require a lot of thoughtful debate to understand what's the right thing to do. Thoughtful debate takes a lot of time. It may take a lifetime. When the first anti-slavery societies were founded in the United States in the 18th century, what was striking about the people who founded them was their clear, conscious understanding that the problem of slavery would not be resolved in their lifetimes. Nevertheless, they were committed to beginning the dialogue and beginning the work. They could have said, oh, well, this isn't going to be fixed in our lifetimes. We might as well go do something that we can fix. But instead, they were willing to take the longer view. Now, this does not mean, don't misunderstand, I'm not counseling people who are suffering to say, oh, it'll be taken care of in time. I'm talking about the people who are trying to alleviate suffering, that it's very hard to take the long view. We tend to tackle problems we think we can resolve, which is one reason why now the political party wants to tackle poverty today, for example, in a serious way. Some problems take a long time to resolve, and the more that we are a nation of short time horizons, a nature of immediate quick solutions, a nature of putting on bumper stickers and fixing blame, the harder it's going to be to recognize and acknowledge that some problems are actually hard. And figuring out the right solution may be hard, and that takes time. I believe that engagement with culture, and when I'm referring to culture, the same way we've been talking about it here, engagement with the arts, I should say, helps us to slow down and to recognize there are things that take time. I may be wrong about that. I can't prove that, but that's my faith.
Well, I'd give an unpopular answer to your question. I don't blame capitalism in the least, because all capitalism does is try to sell you stuff. And somebody's got to buy it. And it seems to me that the problem is a problem of is a breakdown in American culture. Because, you know, what the market does is put a price on everything. What culture should do is tell you what things are above price. And it seems to me that what we've had in our lifetime, really, is a breakdown of, especially a younger generation, of saying that there's some things that are not immediate
competing, you know, values that can compete effectively with the market.
And so, you know, and we've had this, and I think, you know, what's happened in our society, I'll put it in a really, you know, crude way. I think that our society is so prosperous, we've bought off the intellectuals. We've bought off the artists. You know, we'll give you an English department, play there, you know, stay out of our way. And, hey, it's, you know, and the people are, as long as they've got their little comfortable subculture, and we have this breakdown, in a sense, of the arts effectively doing what Stephen is asking for, which is, in a sense, insisting that we create a certain empty space in our life where we consider things carefully, that we create a certain resonance inside of ourselves. And if you don't believe me, consider this. By and large, in the last 30 years, arts education has been removed from public schools across the United States, except in the richest towns in the U.S. The federal government had nothing to do with this. It was municipality versus municipality, the local governments, the county governments, the state governments saying, well, you know, this is the less important thing. And so we now have a school system which is largely focused on producing entry-level workers. And yet, the public rhetoric is, oh, you know, we're entering a global economy in which America will compete on creativity, innovation, ideas, and yet we're taking not only creativity out of the curriculum, but we're taking all the positive forms of socialization that the arts do. I mean, here's something that, you know, you got a weird 14-year-old who's hit puberty, you know, she thinks that she's strange, there's nobody else like her, she's a sophomore. It goes out for a drama club and meets 40 other weird people just like him or her. And then a deeper insight happens. They say, well, maybe we aren't just weird. Maybe we're just one of the kinds of people that we are. Creates a positive form of socialization. Stephen and I were both on the Stanford Daily, a weirder group of people you could not have put together on this planet. But we liked each other. You know, we formed this kind of positive thing. We even got paid. I mean, that was amazing.
Well, if you call that paid.
On a square, hey, you know, for a poet, it was pretty good pay. And you start creating fewer forms of positive socialization, ways in which a kid discovers something about themselves, discovers ways of relating to other people, develops gifts that they have. And now we have a system in which about 30% of kids in the country don't finish high school. You know, in some ways, it's larger. In which, by and large, in the last 20 years, and this is if you take a look at the study, it's online, on the NEA website. In the last 20 years, younger people, 18 to 24, 25 to 34, have gone from the people who read the most in our society 20 years ago to reading the least now. And so, you know, I think we have this colossal failure, and it's been done by you guys. It's been done by local governments, by school boards, by counties, by states. And it just shows you why we don't value these things. So I would say, who do we blame, you know, for this? I wouldn't blame capitalism, which is just this blind market.
Well, nor would I blame drug dealers for drug addiction, we decide to use the drugs.
So if we're going to fix it, we're going to fix it or it's not going to get fixed.
Well, building on that a little bit, and again, I don't want to exactly blame capitalism, but now I'm going to show my other side a little bit. I don't think that young people are very good decision makers. That is, teenagers tend to make bad decisions, part of being a teenager, which you learn. There's a lot of decisions we put in their hands, I think, that we shouldn't. And we put every year more decisions in our hands. Actually, they need fewer decisions. Let me give you one small example, a good piece of data that we hardly ever discuss. Let's think about the minimum wage for a minute. Now, a lot of people are in favor of raising the minimum wage. A lot of people are against it. I happen to be in favor of it. Some people might not be. It doesn't matter. Undiscussed, very well-established piece of data. what the raising minimum wage increases the demand for work. That is, more people want to work. Who wants to work? Teenagers. The dropout rate goes up when the minimum wage is raised because young people, being unable to make the long-term, short-term trade-off because they can't make decisions very well, would rather quit school and go get a low-paying job so they have some cash than stay in school in the hope of getting a higher-paying job later on. It's one of these, every decision we make has hidden costs. With hidden costs, raising the minimum wage, dropout rate goes up. You can't do anything about that. But this goes to the point about capitalism. We put a lot of money into young people's hands, and this is actually true. A lot of people, families that are very poor, their kids are very substantial consumers. It's not always, it's not because they're necessarily engaging in criminal behavior. It's that what money they have, they spend. What money they put together, they go out and buy something with. We put a lot of decisions about what to consume in the hands of children. That's what they amount to, of children. This is something that parents do. We say, well, go out and buy all this stuff, buy your own clothes, buy your own this or that and that. And we call it trusting our children, training our children, a lot of things. But it does create a situation, which one of the reasons young people aren't going to read as much, we tend to trust young people to make the decisions about how they should spend their time. And instead of encouraging or pushing them to spend their time this way or that, or we might say, you know, well-to-do family might say, look, it's the flute or ballet. You're 2 years old. You got to decide now or your life is ruined. Make up your mind. But other than things like that, we tend to give a lot of decisions about how to spend their time. And they're going to spend their time at the things that they think are fun or the things they see their parents. They can mimic what their parents do. And so if we have the kind of lives where we don't go spend an hour, a couple of hours on Sunday afternoon in the museum, we don't sit down with a good, serious book at night, where are the kids going to do it? Where are they going to get the image that this is something that is even possible to do, much less interesting or valuable to do? And so it is a matter of a network of choices that are made, some of the choices in the market, like with the kids, some of the choices that we make as parents about what kind of, and other adults, whether parent or not, we still are modeling behavior, what we're going to model for young people is the important thing to do with your life. Last point about this, because I've got again this point about education, which I mentioned briefly before. I think part of the problem, when you ask about the local school boards and so on, cutting down on arts programs, music programs, a lot of things have gone out the window. One of the problems is because of our increasingly relentless focus on test scores as a way of evaluating success, how many of a school succeed or not, test scores. How many of a charter school is any good, test scores. How many of a should have vouchers or not, test scores. Everything it comes down to these standardized test scores. And so if you're a rational educator, and you want to keep your budget, what do you want to spend your time doing? Teaching the kids to take the test. What else is there to do to keep your budget flowing? So it doesn't have to be, you don't have to sit there and decide, I don't think the arts are important. All you have to do is rationally say, other people don't think the arts are important. Other people think what's important is these test scores. Therefore, I've got to spend my resources on that.
And I would, again, not to be the crypto-Marxist in the group, but the...
That sound very crypto to me.
The emphasis on test scores, again, it seems to me, as a kind of metric philia that comes out of a culture where we have embraced market values above all things.
I agree with that, by the way.
I wonder, you know, we are inclined to believe when we see something, these trend lines of the decline in reading fiction, and we could talk about whether nonfiction counts or not. In your studies, it doesn't. That when things are getting worse, hell is going to, we're going to hell in a handbasket, and that's just the way we're going. There have been some recent refutations of that, say the homicide rate in America has amazingly turned around in the last 10, 15 years. Do we think that this decline in deep literacy of the kind you guys are talking about and wish we could recover is recoverable? Is this a thing that can be turned through the equivalent of effective policing?
Well, I'm not sure about policing.
Well, I'm using the analogy of crime.
Yes, I think it is, and I'll tell you why. Because if you go back a couple of generations, you know, in most of the world, most people were illiterate. Most of the Western world, most people were illiterate. And so, I think the most important thing we should recognize is that reading is not an inherent natural activity. It's a learned personal and social behavior. There's a personal element and there's an element of social behavior. It's an interesting fact, Stephen, which is that when you look correlative, causative studies about reading, what's the most likely prediction whether a kid is going to read or not is whether their parents read to them. That's interesting. The more interesting one is what's the second most powerful predictor, is their parents said, get the hell out of here, I want to read. So their parents wouldn't read to them, but they saw their parents reading all the time, which is what Steve says, it's modeling. And so if you look at this, you know, reading is a behavior that is essentially a socially taught, socially reinforced behavior. And it, I think it develops certain cognitive capacities, in the same way that studying music demonstrably develops certain cognitive capacities. Since, you know, there was a point where this was introduced, where it was fostered, New England and Scotland were the two areas which had the first more or less universal rates of adult literacy, that there's no reason why you could not re-instigate it. And it actually, especially since the problem today in America isn't illiteracy, it's what they're now calling illiteracy, people who can read who choose not to. We are producing the first generation of college graduates who do not read. So I think, and this is what it's a program that that we're actually creating, because when we saw this data, I never planned to issue this report, which is now the most cited NEA report probably in history, is the numbers were so appalling, I didn't feel I was doing my job as a public official by sweeping it under the table, and I thought we had to make an issue of it. And what we wanted to do was to do one exemplary program that wouldn't by itself reverse the trend, but would do two things. Would give a model of an ambitious public sector-led program to try to reinvigorate literacy, and secondly, could provide a model for other people to try other things. They either say, this is a good idea, we want to do something similar, or this is a stupid idea, we want to do something different. So we've created a program called the Big Read, and I've actually got some freebies for you, and I want you to take them. And what it is that we take, wonderful novels with wide appeal. The first two books we did was Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 and Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. We added The Great Gatsby and Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. We'll be adding one book a month, for the next few years. And we're trying to create a situation where a community will take a month and we'll get maybe, take a town, let's say Topeka, Kansas. We get the mayor's office, the library, the school district, the chamber of commerce, the leading newspaper, the leading public radio station, a TV station, and they apply together. We provide them television programming, radio programming, school materials, reader's guides. You know, we have these reader's guides, so I can find one here. We'll give 20,000 of these, 50,000 of these. You know, it's a little booklet on the thing. And we get every high school to assign the book. We get, retirement communities to do it, every library to do events. And we'll have maybe 150 organizations that will partner with us to do 150 events across the month. We'll have billboards, everything else. The Krispy Kreme will stay open all night, and they'll read Their Eyes Were Watching God from beginning to end with free coffee and donuts for everyone. Fahrenheit 451, we have an event in every fire department. We have a book safe bonfire
perverse
at the end. We're just trying to get, because I don't want to have, it's not a Nuremberg rally where you bring everybody into a thing and they all, salute the book. It's you just take, you realize the complexity of the community, and you have every aspect of the community sort of doing this thing. And it's an effort to do three things. One is to take, maybe one of the ways a town, a municipality can define itself is as a place where we read books. So in a sense, it's a civic redefinition of the many things we talk about, sewage issues, traffic, we'll talk about books. Secondly, create a situation where a young person and an old person, maybe in the same family within a community, read the same book at the same time and talk about it. So you create intergenerational conversations, because most people, we sit around and say, those kids today, they just don't read the way we did, rather than sort of, becoming, in a sense, part of the solution ourselves. And the third thing is to take basically public discourse, be it billboards, radio, television, newspapers, and have literature one of the things they talk about seriously. And so we're going to be doing this, essentially in about 200 cities across the United States. We tested it in 10 cities. And, we're hoping that this becomes, in a sense, a public model of re-engaging literature and public life in the United States.
First of all, do you think it'll work?
Yeah. I think it'll work I think the best thing to say about the idea is that we didn't invent it at the NEA. It's a grassroots idea that people have tried in communities, and what we're trying to do is to provide from Washington those things that the community cannot provide on itself: high quality programming, beautiful, you know, full color readers guides, but let them figure out how to do it with their community, and first of all, to figure out what book they want to do, not have us tell them what book to do. Is it enough in and of itself? No, but I believe that it's sort of what Stephen said, the same kind of modeling that goes on in a family goes on in communities. I think maybe one of the problems in America right now is we don't have a lot of good public models for things. We don't have, you know, the Albert Schweitzers, you know, that we need right now. What we have, you know, is really a relatively low level of public discourse and public behavior.
Now, the study that so dispirited you and is shocking in many ways required reading of poetry, drama, or fiction to qualify as still reading. Stephen Carter, you've written a second novel. You've also published 7 or 8 or 9 nonfiction books. Do you buy that privileging of the novel over the thoughtful nonfiction book as a measure of our...
Can I defend myself first?
Society's called it. You may.
Okay. Well, you don't know if you're going to have anything to defend yourself against.
But I want to make sure you know what we're talking about. You have to understand, this was not designed to be a study on American literacy. Every 10 years, the NEA does the largest study in the world of arts participation. And we go into 17,000 households. It's the year after the census. The U.S. Bureau of Census takes 17,000 households that replicates the U.S. population as measured in the previous year. We measure everything from, you know, whether they go to the opera, ballet, listen to jazz, listen to music, whether they, you know, do volunteer work. We don't, unfortunately, measure whether they vote or not, which I'm going to try to add into the study. And we ask them all of these behaviors, and we're able to correlate at a very high level of statistical reliability what they do and what they don't do, and how different behaviors interact. And so, because we're at the Arts Endowment, what we measured was literature traditionally. Now, I added a couple questions on nonfiction. The trouble is we don't have 20 years of data
right on
it. But I will say, depressingly, all reading is down to the degree we measure it. And we measure, our key measure is, during the last 12 months, did you read any novel, short story, poem, or work of drama in a book, in a magazine, in a newspaper, online? If you have in your wallet, you know, a little poem you pull out, you know, and read in times of troubles, we count you.
12% of Americans read poetry, according to your study.
And if you read all of Proust last year again in French, or you read one page of a Harlequin novel and gave up because it was too hard, we count you as equals. So the trouble with our study,
good democratic policy,
is that it's too permissive. This shows actually a rosier picture than we really have.
Even though less than half of the people, Americans, qualify according to your rules.
56% of people read at least some part of one book a year. But only, but if you take the literary component, even with that really broad measure, only about 47% of people, 46.7% of people read. The younger people have a line that's going like this, but every group of Americans, every age group, income group, education group, every racial group, as measured by the census, is declining. Every region is declining. Both genders are declining.
Well, don't tell me that. I write for a living. I don't want to hear any of that. I don't believe any of that is true. It's certainly the case, I think, that all books are not created equal. It's not that fiction as such is better than nonfiction as such. Right now, publishing goes to these cycles. Publishing happens to be dominated by nonfiction rather than fiction. Right now, most of it is junk. Most of it is junk. It's disposable stuff that people will buy, read a few pages of, and won't ever read again. And a great novel, but also some great nonfiction you might want to read again and again. I think there's a reason for this. There's a reason for these different attitudes. It's striking that one of the books that Dana mentioned, these is Fahrenheit 451, which I'm always appalled at how few of my students have read it, I should add, for the following reason. I like to ask my students, in Fahrenheit 451, why did they ban the books? And they they haven't read it. They haven't read anything. They read the Cliff's Notes on a few things when they were in high school. And they say, well, because they had to protect the ruling class, their objectionable ideas, they go to this long litany of the things. And, of course, none of that is true, right? If you look at the interview with the fire chief in Vatican 451, he explains the reason they banned the books, burned the books, was that the books were too hard. The public itself wanted to get rid of most books because they were just too hard. The ideas were too hard. The things they confronted you with were too hard. The images were too hard. The language was too hard. The books were too hard.
It made people unhappy.
And so that's why you could have little instruction manuals and things like that. That was what people... And his view was this was an upswelling. This was a groundswell. This was something from... the grassroots. And I think, and this is what I worry about a little bit in publishing today, that fiction and nonfiction both lists are dominated by stuff that's not really hard to read. So that it's not challenging very much. Even the mean-spirited political books on the left and the right, they're only read by people who agree with them anyways. They don't challenge anything. Nobody reads those unless they're a reviewer. No one reads them unless, oh, yeah, I agree so-and-so is a big fat idiot or whatever. It may stay on the cover.
So
I think I'm going to read that. But here's the thing. This is what I really wanted to say, that it's not just books that I think people should engage. And I want to emphasize it's books that are hard, books that challenge us not just because we don't agree with them, but because the act of reading them actually provides some difficulty to us. It is the working through of that difficulty, it is the triumph of getting to the appreciation of the book in spite of the difficulty of language, especially of the classics, for a reason I'll mention in a moment, that I think creates in us the mindset of being able and ready to take on and have actual conversation with, in a serious way, people whom we disagree. Right now, I think one of the reasons that we are so bad... I was on a panel in Civility last night, but there was someone else who didn't get to talk very much, so I'm going to tell you what I was going to say on that panel. One of the reasons that we're so bad at conversation with people we disagree with is fear. It's fear. That is, a lot of us have very strong... I don't want to say convictions, very strong opinions about a lot of stuff. And we are raised and even socialized to be fierce in our opinions. What we don't do very well is defend them. We have little experience in actually constructing an argument or in actually figuring out what's wrong with someone else's. So if I say I disagree, that can be a very ego-threatening experience because then I've got to come up with reasons for what I think, reasons that might be comprehensible to someone who doesn't think the same thing, and I don't know how to do that. No one's ever showed me how to make an argument. I have no experience, no models of how that's done, so I want to demonize the person who disagrees with me instead. I honestly believe I may be wrong. I honestly believe there's no better training for the construction of argument. There's no better training for the patience that it takes to think about arguments, including other people's arguments, than reading through things that are hard. Not hard because they're badly written. Hard because they challenge. Hard because they take us in unusual places. Hard because they actually demand of us the entire focus of our mind in order to make what we're reading really useful and comprehensible to us. And it's that skill that I worry is being lost, even when young people read things that are assigned to them, many of which are classics that would easily meet this description. They're reading it for the test. And their old hands, and some of them fall in love with reading, that's a wonderful thing, but a lot of these kids, very smart kids, these kids are going to get straight A's and A's on their SATs. What they've learned how to do is read the book in the way you've got to read it to ace the test and never see the book or think about the book again, unless you're taking the English AP test. And then you've got to think about just enough of it to write the right kind of essay, and then you're done with having to teach at Yale Law School, which at the moment, it's not always so, but in the recent years has been the hardest law school in the country to get into. These are really smart kids. They're really bright. They have all these Phi Beta Kappa kids from all these great schools. Half of these kids, in my judgment, cannot write the English language. They just can't do it. That is, they can write things that look like, you know, that you can figure out what they meant, you know, speaking of things that are hard to read. But the notion, the metaphor, irony, the notion of language that sings to you, the notion that language itself is something to be appreciated. It's not merely a tool. It is a wonder. This is entirely foreign to them. And if someone else writes this way, they quickly learn, they've learned somewhere not to appreciate that writing unless that writing is on the test. And that's the concern that I have. That's why I worry about the capacity to appreciate or make arguments because of all of those losses.
Before we open up the discussion here to questions from the audience, I wanted to ask you one more thing about the differences of what of the kinds of knowledge and insight and understandings that can be expressed in fiction versus nonfiction. There's among the many lovely scenes and wonderful things in your wonderful novel, Emperor of Ocean Park, there's a scene where the hero Talcott who's black, goes to a white daycare center to pick up his kid and feels condescended to by all these well-meaning white caregivers and is offended. Now, as an idea, as a part of the black experience, is that something that you believe can be done more truthfully the way you did it in a work of fiction than you could have in an essay?
Well, I don't want to say truthfully or not. I do think it's an easier idea to communicate in that form. When writing a scene like that, I want to provide an insight into a certain experience without getting people's hackles and defenses up. I want them to feel this flowing in the work in which they're already caught up, as opposed to, here's an essay about something that happened to me, and getting people to feel defensive about it. I think that there are ways in which you can, in literature, bring certain kinds of arguments to life in ways that are sometimes harder. They shouldn't be harder. It would be nice if simply making an argument and confronting people with an idea, people's hackles didn't rise. It's just not always that way in real life.
And I wanted to ask you, Dana, a final question. As you've now, for, I guess, 5 years?
4 years.
4 years been in this job. When you presumably leave Washington, D.C. one day, and return to writing poetry, if you're not writing poetry at this moment and you're at night, will you bring your experience of helping to nudge and manage our democracy into poetry, or is poetry an entirely other thing for you in terms of its subject?
Well, you know, I mean, a writer writes out of the sum of their life experience. And, I mean, I think as you know, when things happened, my first son died. That changed me as a poet. Now, obviously, that works more into the thematics of traditional poetry. But, you know, where you live changes, you know, the way that you write. And so I think that I'll probably write differently for having had this experience. Or at least if I'm going to write well. I mean, what I hope in my own case is that one of my books is not just like the one before it. You know, and so, and I'm comforted by the notion that, you know, certain poets, you know, like Goethe, you know, Dante got involved in politics, though it didn't end very well for Dante. You know, he had to flee his native city, you know, with a capital crime over his head. I would like to think it will, but, you know, we'll have to see. Maybe it'll make my poetry worse. You know.
But there'll be no poems about counting votes in the House or anything like that.
If the muse dictates.
If any of you have questions, yes, sir.
Yeah, just a quick one. I'm Mutabara from Zimbabwe. How universal are the models that we use for analysis? How universal are the frameworks we use to analyze the raw culture and democracy? For example, when you say art, when you say poetry, is it the same thing for the impoverished poor people in the ghettos and for the elites in Aspen? To what extent are our models culture sensitive? When you say hard novel, what's a hard novel? Is it a hard novel for every community or for a particular community? How culture sensitive are our models? For example, when you say two measures, whether a child is going to read is depends on whether the parents used to read for that. What if there are no parents? What if I've got a single parent or zero parents? Mm-hmm. How culture sensitive are our models for analysis?
Yeah, well, what I try to do with the endowment is redefine the endowment in a sense that we serve all Americans, which is not really the way that it had been run before, you know, which is to say that, you know, to make sure that we're reaching every community. And the thing that I want to make sure, and this is, I mean, I don't know how culturally sensitive this is that we don't condescend to anyone. I mean, I think that what I see is the worst kind of cultural policy is one in which says, well,
these people are a little less fortunate than the three of us, so, you know, we'll talk down to them. We'll give them stuff that's just good enough for them. And so what I've done, for example, one of the signature programs of the endowment is a program called Shakespeare for American Communities. I've got 60 theater companies that have gone, at this point, to 1,200 municipalities with productions of Shakespeare. You know, we get a theater, we sell tickets, and you tend to have the Aspen crowd, the NPR crowd comes, people like us. And then we fill the rest of the seats with high school kids. And these are mostly kids, overwhelmingly, have never seen a play before. And we're doing it, you know, in everything from rural communities to inner city communities to Indian nations, and making this thing available. And most of the places that we go to are small and mid-sized community or inner city communities. And I think that that's what it is, where you say, you offer what, if you believe that art is transformative, if you believe that it does something that is irreplaceable, then everybody should have equal access to that. And so you know, that. Another thing in terms of this program, we have a panel of 24 of the most distinguished people in the United States that are picking these books. And the argument with it, that I'm having with them is, I want a book that can appeal across the community. You know, and so we have to have some books that are like Fahrenheit 451 and To Kill a Mockingbird. The reason they're on there is not because the panel chose them. Those are the books that most often grassroots programs like this have picked for themselves. And so I want books that range from, you know, literary classics to what, you know, Harold Bloom would might think of as middle brow, because the objective is, in a sense, to give people a long list of books that they can pick for themselves, a book that's right for their community, without us saying, creating too strict of a literary hierarchy. I will insist that I want something, these books should all be good, I think, good in their own ways. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it's, you know.
Well, let me give a part of my answer. First of all, the data about parents reading contributing to the kids' learning and the kids' love of reading is largely independent of what the parents read. I emphasize that for the following reason. Some of you probably know Mae Jemison, who used to be on Aspen a lot. She was also at Stanford when we were there. She was the first black woman in space. She was an astronaut. She's a doctor. And she does a lot of speaking in inner city communities about education. And one of the themes of her talks, what I've heard her give, is the importance of parents reading. And she has a view, which is actually largely correct, that in many cases with kids raised in very poor circumstances in the United States and the inner city, it's not that the parents or the single mom in most cases doesn't have time to read to the kids, that the single mom is watching television. That's the thing. And so one of her campaigns to try to get some of these families just turn off their television for a few hours a week and read to their kids then, which they actually could. They could physically, they have the physical and even the literacy tools to do that. They're simply not exercising the tools. It's a matter of the choice issue again. Second, so what about a kid who has no parents and no one who can read? My wife was raised in the inner city in New York by an aunt and uncle who were functionally illiterate. So they couldn't read to her, but she ended up being a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Barnard College and went to Yale Law School. Why? Because, well, they couldn't read to her. They couldn't provide for education, but they scrimped and saved and sent her to Catholic school. And they basically stood over her to make sure she was doing her homework, to make sure that, you know, if she ever brought anything, tell them wasn't A, they were in their senior teachers. They didn't know. They couldn't really help her with the work, but they could help make sure that she took her work seriously and got her work done. So there are things that the parents do. It's hard stuff to do. It's a lot of burden to put on these families. But a lot of this stuff cannot be fixed programmatically. There's not a, you can't have an official government program of parents reading to kids. You can try to encourage it, but you couldn't like now we're going to have a program of social workers go house to house and read or something like that. There's some things families have to do, and it's really hard to get them to do. That's why Mae Jemison is doing the things that she does. That's why others have to. With the families in the city that my wife and I used to work with in New Haven, one of the things we really encouraged was reading for just this, for exactly that reason. You raise it. It's a very important point, because the solution is not going to fit everyone, but there is space in almost every family to do some of this. What worries me now, though, is now that we're in the next and sometimes the third generations of some of these very young inner city families where the mothers don't know how to read, where the mothers dropped out of school and didn't learn to read. This is more worrisome than my wife's generation and the other generation of kids we've been working with. And I don't know the solution to that yet.
Yes, sir. through. I have a question and a comment. Of course, I'm not sure if I heard it correctly. But Professor Kauf, did you say that there are three Western religions or two?
I said three.
Yes.
I said three major Western religions. Yes.
Then which are the three major Western religions?
What I had in mind were Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. But you may have a different view.
Well, if it's Islam, which would be new for me, then I'm wondering which Islamic novelists, poets, musicians, played philosophers are playing a big role in Western tradition.
I'm not sure I understand the question. My claim was not about what is foundational to the West. My claim was that these religions have survived in large part because they rely centrally on a book. That was my only claim. It was not my claim about their role in the West. I'm not making any such claim.
Second, my comment is, I sympathize with, I agree with the comment there, Goya, that even at the Aspen Festival of Ideas, arts and culture is a kind of on the fringe, sidetrack, etc., etc., etc. What we may notice, we are here with a handful of people, is that for the whole elite, because the Aspen Festival of Ideas is organized by and for the elite, the whole elite doesn't care anything about it. You know, they are over there and they are not here. So it's not only a phenomenon of lower class people who get, because all those people are educated at Harvard, Yale, whatever. They have a brilliant education and they simply are not interested in what you are talking about. Why? I think that the arguments you have presented only will make sense if you also include the complexity of the issue in the sense that history has taught us that there is no relationship at all between high culture and a better society. It was already Nietzsche who pointed out that at the very moment you will have your democracy, you will have the decline of your high culture. I can make an endless list of great poets and novelists. Dostoevsky had nothing with democracy. T.S. Eliot was against it. Céline was a fascist, and so on and so forth. We can also know all too well the whole elite in Germany, World War I, the whole French elite in France, and so on and so forth, who were very different. And we may include after 9/11 our own intellectual elite, who read all the poetry, who knows all the novels, who know every piece of chamber music of Schaeffer or Schubert by heart, and are not capable to make any sensible moral judgment on what happened with 9/11. So, the point is that definitely in the United States, but it is also growing in Europe, there is a kind of democratic intuition that apparently all this thing of intellectual high stuff and reading books and reading poetry and also on so forth, history has proven that there is no connection. For example, Dr. Faustus of Thomas Mann is all about the fact of the relationship, the close neighborship between culture, aestheticism and barbarism. So again, if you don't take these things into account, then you create this, as I listen to it, it's very, very superficial. It is extremely superficial. And that's, nobody benefits from that.
Well, you've raised a lot of issues. Let me see if I can address them. Because, obviously, we cannot do full justice to, all of these issues in an informal conversation. But what you've said is two things, one of which I want to agree with, which I think there is a very reasonable democratic intuition, to use your phrase at the moment, that there's something wrong with culture. And I think that the democratic intuition is quite right, that something has broken in high culture, which does not, to the average person, fulfill the needs that they believe it should fulfill. That being said, I don't believe that the judgment of a healthy culture is ever a one-to-one utilitarian equivocation between the personal beliefs of the artists and the cumulative impact on art in terms of its general human purposes. Now, let me just say this. I probably should have said this as a preliminary definition. Is that one of my beliefs is that art, and if I can just talk about literature, so I can put it in linguistic terms.
that literature is not science or philosophy for the feeble-minded. That there is, in a sense, different ways of knowing and expressing the world which are independent of one another, and yet equally valuable. One is scientific, one is analytical, and that what literature does, what poetry does, what the novel does, is present life in a holistic way which addresses you as a complete human being. Your intellect, your emotions, your physical body, your intuition, your memory, your imagination, all together without asking you to separate that. This allows us to express, and it's interesting the way that the incident that you asked Stephen about in his novel, to express certain human realities more clearly and more directly. That when a society loses that capability, they lose one of the necessary languages of human experience, of human wisdom.
I wish I could believe that, but if you simply take the fact that the intellectual elite who have the time, the privilege, the possibility of reading everything they want to read, and they read everything, right? Then why, another Kucho Malaput, his book Kaput, right, when he's attending the dinner parties of Bruno Frank, the Gauleiter in Poland, where Himmler and all those people were there, they were very, very educated people. And they knew the Renaissance, and they knew Dante by heart.
And therefore what?
And therefore what? The point is that, unfortunately, you cannot make the connection between, at the very moment, your culture. You are also a morally better person.
Let me address that, because I actually agree with the last part of what you said. My argument is not that the cultured intellectual is the better person. You mentioned Dr. Faustus, for example. I don't think that Dr. Faustus is about the relationship between culture and barbarism and evil. It's about the cultured person seeing himself as different and distinct from his fellows and barbarism and evil. And I think, if you take someone like Heidegger, for example, you know, what's striking about Heidegger is his sense of his own specialness and his own distinctiveness is what allows him to end up, despite his sophistication as a philosopher, with some of the really endorsing some of the barbaric things that he does. I mean, I really think that one wants to distinguish the claim that an educated person is a good person, which is not my claim, from the claim that engaging in culture helps us, doesn't guarantee, helps us to engage arguments and difference. Now, you can go overboard. You mentioned the problem of a lot of Western intellectuals being able to find a moral point to 9/11. I agree that's a tragedy and it's also an absurdity that you have many people in that position. But it's true, you do have a lot of people in that position. But one of the reasons I think you have a lot of people in that position is precisely the same sense of specialness and uniqueness. I'm a special, different kind of person. And so the very fact that everybody else is running around upset about this suggests that there must be something wrong. The mob can't be right, so I have to stake out a different position. But that's not. But so I'm not making a claim about education and goodness, nor do I believe it to be true. I'm making a claim about engaging in culture and that act of engagement, facilitating the act of engagement with other people, which is fundamental democracy. See, that's
also
the claim that I'm making.
The point I was making, which I think I didn't explain it well enough, is that to the degree that you take this the language of aesthetic experience and say, well, I like that so much, I'm going to replace analytical language with that, that we're going to aestheticize politics is dangerous, in the same way that politicizing, insisting that everything that goes on in this aesthetic experience must be reduced to political abstractions. You have to recognize, in a sense, the separate nature, the separate but important and irreplaceable natures of these different types of knowledges and discourses.
But that's why this is a good question. It forced us to refine what we were saying in a good way.
It's an extremely profound question, and expressed in a very well-informed way. Mm. But I think what Mann is talking about in a funny way is the aestheticization of politics. You know, and it's also the intellectual, the totalitarianism of music in a Schoenbergian system, in a funny way. The unpleasant interpenetration of these two types of human realities. But it's a very good question. You know, we can talk about it later.
Another question.
I really enjoyed your comment about your explanation of why fiction and why poetry is important, because it helps you get to the interiority of other people's lives. But I have found that over the past 10 years or so, my reading has moved from maybe 60% of fiction to maybe 30% fiction. And I'm reading more and more biographies and autobiographies. And it would seem to me that biography and autobiography can also serve that same function of helping you to get to the end.
Yeah. And I think different phases of your life, different individuals and different circumstances read, you know, different sorts of books, and that's great.
It's also a fact of publishing that women today vastly outnumber men as readers of long fiction.
Yeah, almost by 2-1 now.
Yeah. Damn.
Just was wondering what part you feel the latest rash of plagiarism perhaps is kind of hurting people's trust in, you know, the writer and the novelist or the historian, like A Million Little Pieces, or the young gal that just wrote the novel.
Well, wrote the novel. Yeah.
Yes.
Assembled.
but you know, it's funny about plagiarism. Let me just say a small thing about that. I hope it'll be an unimportant blip. I also worry sometimes when I see, because I find something once I wrote down in a notebook and then copied into my, and I didn't do it right, and I'm going to be labeled as a plagiarist. Who knows? Maybe my day will come. So I'm not going to cast any stones. But I do think that you want to distinguish two things that are being called plagiarism. Thing number one, someone who is a historian writes a history and doesn't properly cite all the sources. No one's claiming that the history is wrong. You see, no one's claiming, oh, since the footnote's not there, the fact must be wrong. It's only that the source wasn't cited. That's different. I think that shouldn't shake our faith in the historian in the way that only that the novelist or the autobiographer who's manufacturing, that's different, of course. And that could, of course, shake us as readers. But the other one, which, while it's important to get sources right, I don't think it should make us think that the person likely to be wrong because they didn't cite the source, they copied it from someone else. That may be an unethical thing to do, and in some cases may be actionable, but it doesn't mean that it's not evidence that the history itself is in error, and that's what makes that.
I think we're in a culture right now where, I mean, Stephen talked about these very disposable books. People are writing rapidly. I myself have been plagiarized many times. And the first time I saw myself plagiarized, I said, well, should I complain about this? And I said, well, no, I felt rather complimented that this person would like my ideals enough to steal without acknowledgement, you know?
You've been sampled.
Yeah. What it was is essentially my ideas entering the mainstream, you know, maybe rather less politely. But I think part of it is just people are writing, people that aren't real writers, aren't real researchers, that are knocking together books and just pulling together, they're assembling books. And, you know, it's the downside of the commodity culture that we've been talking about.
Well, and in that particular young woman's case at Harvard, I think it connects very much to what, Stephen, you were saying about kids today gaming the culture to succeed effectively. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Sorry, can you speak a little louder? I'm sorry.
Sure. I so appreciate what you've said about the hard novel and about reading the variety of literature. That's important to me, just to be able to do the comparative studies among them. What I see so often, and I haven't seen any data on it, is so many readers today picking up books because they're used to the quick action, nothing deep, but a lot of quick movement, short chapters, Dan Brown, John Grisham. Do you see any difficulty in the readership that is really going more toward just that quick activity rather than learning to appreciate literature because of the difficulty?
I don't know. And first of all, let me just say as a novelist that, of course, Dan Brown and John Grisham are gods you worship at their shrine. I don't want to think anything bad about them. But here's the thing. I do think that publishers follow trend in fiction and nonfiction alike. And so a publisher will say, if there's a kind of novel that's selling well, let's try to get more of that. And what Dan Brown and John Grisham have in common, they're both inheritors of what used to be called in publishing the Ludlum formula. It was always called that because Robert Ludlum's novel has always had the three titles, and the second was the guy's name. And the Ludlum formula was very simple. Ludlum formula was, there's a terrible threat out there. There's one guy who knows it. Nobody will believe him. The bad guys are chasing him because they're bad. The good guys are chasing him because they don't believe him. He meets a girl who does believe him. She has some talent by which together they resolve the situation and the world is saved and they write him in the sense. That's Ludlum wrote, you know, 30 books of that formula and they were all big bestsellers and more power to him. And so the publishers like that. That's a formula. And the issue isn't whether people do it badly or well. Some people do it badly, some people do it well. It's that publishers Well, they're always looking for something new, and that'll help break out, and that's a nice thing. If you can't find anything new, then you want to replicate what you think the public is buying. I'll tell you from my own experience that when I published Amber of Ocean Park, when it was first in market 5 years ago, most publishers not only had never published a serious novel about that was set in the milieu of these old African-American families have been around for a while, been educated for all the money for a while. They didn't know it existed. And since it's been published and was very successful, a lot of novels set there have been published, and that's good. I mean, I'm happy to have people writing and thinking about this this other world. The problem the publisher has, most people who are in publishing are people who love literature. And they would love to be publishing the next piece of great literature that's really going to make people stand up and take notice of a great literary talent. Their problem is they don't think anybody will read it. They don't see a way to promote it. How can you persuade the Today Show to put on, you know...
any novelist.
Any novelist, first of all, yeah. Any novelist other than John Grisham or Dan Brown. But also, you know, if the next Proust comes along, right, how are they going to package that for a three-minute segment on morning television? And so it's not that the publishers are sitting around saying, I don't like that highbrow stuff. They love that stuff. They just don't know how.
They're making the same economic market capitalist choices as the rest of us.
That's exactly right.
But, you know, to something very directly is that it's interesting. I've read aloud to both of my sons, and a lot of the things I read were books that I liked when I was, you know, 9 years old, 10 years old. And I began reading Edgar Rice Burroughs, which was published in pulp magazines for adolescent boys in 1912, 1920. And, you know, it'll be, and then after this, the sentence, I'm making the sentence, after this pugilistic encounter, Tarzan looked through the canopy of the tropical veldt up to the emperor. You know, I'm looking at incredible vocabulary. And it was taken for granted that, an adolescent boy would have that vocabulary 80 years ago, 90 years ago. What worries me is when the books that I read that are not generated by other books, not by this great tapestry of words that we've created, but are almost seems as if they're dictated by the vocabulary of television. Sentence, short sentence structure, these things like Sweet Valley High or Goosebumps, where there is not a single vocabulary word that isn't, you know, part of the 700 words that are used on television. That's what's scary. is that they're generated by the mass media rather than they're generated by literature.
Going toward that and losing focus on the more difficult.
Yeah. And a kid raised on that kind of place, even though they've read 50 books, Tarzan of the Apes might as well, be Dr. Faustus. Please, everybody, don't leave without taking some of these CDs. They're free. When you're caught in traffic, you will thank me for having foisted them on you.
And we'll be back next year when we're less marginalized. Thank you very much.
I need to ask you.
We're out of time.
So Shakespeare started in the oral tradition.